This is Digital Story Podcast number 762, October 27th, 2020. Today's theme is The Rules We Follow But Not Sure Why. I'm Derek Story. I'm having more conversations than ever about photography, and I think part of the reason is that we're all cooped up and not going to conferences and workshops. One of the things that I've picked up on are some classic self-imposed rules. So I picked a few of my favorites to discuss for today's show. Like practically everything else in photography, there are no right and wrong answers to just about anything, right? Yet many of us, myself included, find ourselves constrained by rules that should or should not always apply to our work. And this reminds me a little bit of golf. Golf is one of those sports that you can actually go backwards when you play. I mean, you can improve, and then somehow magically you pick up a bad habit. You don't actually know where it comes from, but suddenly you're doing this thing wrong. And so all your tee shots are slicing, or you're not getting underneath the ball, you're topping the ball, you're raising up. You're doing all these things that you weren't doing 2 weeks ago. And I think sometimes in photography, we have these things crop up as well, and we just start doing them, and then we don't question them, and then they become, you know, these constraints that we're not sure why we're doing them, but we're doing them anyway. And I think sometimes it takes maybe someone else, you know, looking at your shots to go, well, why did you make that decision? And you're going, well, because I do that all the time. And the other person goes, why? Why do you do that all the time? And then you're going, I'm not sure, actually. And then you can kind of go from there. So as I've been having these conversations online, you know, with our virtual workshop and the other things that we're doing, I thought I'm going to keep track of a few of these and share them on the podcast. And so that's what we're going to do this week. We're going to tackle a few of these self-imposed rules and just talk about them for a second and see what we think. Now, as you may have guessed, I have five of these, and we'll start with the first one. The subject should never go in the middle of the frame. So this is a compositional rule. And somewhere along the lines, we were taught rule of thirds or one of the other compositional rules. And suddenly, we're not allowed to put subjects in the middle of the frame anymore. But the thing about this is that sometimes some subjects should be in the middle of the frame, right? Some shots look better with the subject, bam, right there. You got your nine squares, right, from your rule of thirds, and it goes right there in the middle one, right? Tic-tac-toe, boom, right there in the middle. So why is that? How do we get away from ever doing that? Well, because when we start out in photography, our inclination is to put the subject in the middle of the frame. That is the natural thing to do. In film days, you know, the focusing, you know, micro prism was there, and so you would be focusing right there, and then you just stay right there and take the shots. Also, just there's something natural about putting things in the middle of things for us. So we start out doing that, more or less, in our early days. And then someone tells us, if you want to be a good photographer, right, not just a snap shooter, then you will move your subjects somewhere else in the frame to create what we call dynamic tension. Ooh, that sounds good. I want to do that. I want to have dynamic tension in my shots, too. So then we learn about, for example, the rule of thirds, where now my subject should be over to the right or over to the left or down a little bit or up a little bit. But for heaven's sakes, not in the center, because that's what rookies do, not people like me who are trying to be good photographers. For the most part, I would say that that is true. For the most part, you do not want the subject there, right smack dab, in the center all the time. However, like so many rules, sometimes they're meant to be broken. And there are certain shots, and you know the shots I'm talking about. If you're going to shoot a thistle flower at a certain stage, You want to put that thistle, you want to get tight on it for one thing, and you want to put that thistle right there in the middle of the frame, because that's where, you know, it's this symmetrical, beautiful symmetrical flower with the purples and the whites and everything, some green in there. Bam, right there in the middle, and get your focus right. So there are some times when, yes, we do want to move things over, but then there are other times when we go, look, this thing belongs right in the center. So it's a rule that's meant to be broken, like so many rules. Here's another one. And this one just came up in our virtual workshop, and we're having a little chat about it. But it's come up many times for me before, so I'm glad it came up in our workshop so that I could chat about it today, which is when you're cropping your photos, a lot of photographers like to keep their original aspect ratio when cropping, because somehow, and to tell you the truth, it's an inclination that I have myself, that it is truer to what I did in camera. So even though I'm cropping the image, so it is not going to be the same shot that I took per se, right? Because I'm going to trim off some things on top, bottom, left, right. However, I'm being more honest somehow, subconsciously, by keeping the original aspect ratio when I'm cropping. And I know a number of photographers that just sort of naturally do this without thinking about it. I want to say right now that unless you're printing to a specific paper size, you can crop to any aspect ratio that you want. In other words, I think most of the time, the best crop is freeform. In other words, don't have any constraints on it at all, and just move the handles until you get the crop exactly the way you want. Hit OK or whatever. Look at the image after you've cropped it. Go, did I crop it too much? Does it need a little bit more? Should I move it to the left or right? Should I move it to the center? Right? Stuff like that. But really look at it. But don't be constrained by any particular aspect ratio. You are not limited, and you do not have to stick to the original aspect ratio to be true to your photography. So that's another one I hear come up a lot. You don't have to do it. Go freeform. Let your hair fly in the wind and crop that thing so that it looks fantastic regardless of the aspect ratio. Here's the third one. I don't use high ISOs because there is too much noise. And for a while, right, this was a big deal back in the day. And I'm talking about now, I'm talking like 10 years ago or more that this was an issue. But today we can go, I mean, the starting point for low-light photography now is ISO 1600. That's the starting point where that would be the absolute cap once upon a time. We can start at 1600 and we can go up to 25. We can go up to, you know, 50,000. We can play with what our cameras can handle, because if you get a little bit of noise or you even get a moderate amount of noise, we can get rid of it. And you have the shot and it is sharp because the shutter speed was fast enough or, you know, whatever you needed to do. So noise can be handled. Now, depending on what type of camera you shoot with and what the imaging pipeline is, you will have more latitude in terms of going higher ISO. And of course, one of the things is to learn what is your comfortable ceiling for high ISO with the particular camera that you have. Some cameras is going to be lower than other cameras. So you figure that out. Don't stop there. Once you figure that out, that is just the ISO that you're comfortable with without having to do any noise reduction in post-production. Remember, we have all these great tools that are so readily available. You probably have them on your computer right now that would allow you to go up another stop or two in terms of ISO, get the shot the way that you want it, and then just take care of noise reduction in post. The algorithms these days for noise reduction is fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic. And all you have to do then is, if you don't have it already, is just find the software that allows you to shoot the way that you want. So two steps to this one. The first step is, okay, find the ISO, the high ISO that you're comfortable with your particular camera without noise reduction, and then find a noise reduction application that allows you to go higher than that for those shots where you need to. Here's one that I find interesting, and I actually do hear this a fair amount. I only shoot natural light because flash looks artificial. And this is a technique constraint as far as I'm concerned. What do I mean by that? Well, I'm going to talk about a photographer friend of mine. His name is Rick Salmon. You probably have heard the name, who is an excellent travel photographer. And one of the things that Rick does so well when he's out in the world is take portraits of people in different places. And his people shots are fantastic. And what he does, more often than not, is he uses fill flash to get those beautiful people shots. Now, when you look at one of Rick Salmon's travel portraits, you're probably not going to say that the shot looks artificial. You're probably going to say, this shot looks very natural, very appealing, and I like it. That's probably what you're going to say more often than not. So what is his trick? How does he do that? How does he use this flash that so many people are so, not afraid of, but definitely concerned about using it because they don't want their shots to look, you know, flashy? How does he do that? It's very simple. He just uses flash exposure compensation, dials back the flash one f-stop. So if the flash, you know, wants to have this amount of output, then he dials it back so that it has one f-stop less output than the automatic system wants to do. By doing that, you get a very natural fill flash, and you're really not going to think that that shot was captured with flash at all. You're probably just going to be looking at the portrait thinking, I wish I had taken that. So my point is, with people who shoot natural light only, and especially for portraits, is that it's a technique constraint rather than an actual reality. Because if you learn the technique, if you learn techniques using fill flash, for example, that's the easiest one for me to point out, then you will learn that you can control the flash, you can bend it to your will to get the kind of shots that you want that have a natural light look. However, you get to see the eyes, you get to smooth out the skin a bit, you get some of that benefit that you get from a light coming forward onto your subject instead of always from the side or above or wherever. So natural light is great. I love natural light portraits, and I especially like them with reflectors or maybe a little bit of diffuser or something. But I am not afraid to use a flash if I have to, because I know how to use it. And if you want to be able to get good looking portraits in any kind of lighting, I highly recommend taking a look at some fill flash techniques. Look at some of Rick Salmon's work for inspiration. Here's my fifth one. Program mode is for rookies only, right? It's for rookies only. And why would that be? Well, it's because the camera is making all the exposure decisions for you. In other words, it's choosing the aperture, and it's choosing the shutter speed as well. Instead of you being more involved, let's say shooting aperture priority, where you choose the f-stop and the camera chooses the shutter speed, or shooting shutter priority where you choose the shutter speed and the camera chooses the aperture program mode, it does both. And because it does both, some people feel like, well, you know, I'm not being a real photographer because I'm letting the camera do too much of the heavy lifting. You may have heard the joke that the P on the exposure mode dial doesn't stand for program, but it stands for professional. That's professional mode. And the joke is because so many professionals start out in program mode for a lot of their work. Why do they do that? Well, because by leaving your camera in program mode and auto ISO, then when you turn on your camera and take a quick shot, it will probably come out. You don't have time to play with the aperture or the shutter speed or figure out the ISO because you saw something and you want to grab it before it goes away. And we know how fast shots go away, right? When you're out in the world, you have boom, 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 and then if you haven't captured the shot by then, it's probably gone. So leaving your camera, the default setup in program mode with auto ISO means that if you see something, then all you have to do is turn on your camera, if it's not on already, and grab the shot, boom, and you'll probably get a nice exposure. Now, beyond that, if you want to control the depth of field, yes, you go to aperture priority. If you want to control the motion in the shot, either have motion showing where you slow down the shutter speed or freeze motion for sports, then yes, you go to shutter priority and play with the shutter speeds. But in terms of leaving your camera in a default exposure mode, I highly recommend program. And I also highly recommend auto ISO. You can set the parameters to, you know, wherever you want in it, in almost all cameras these days. And don't miss shots. Don't miss shots. You can fiddle around later on, but program mode is not for rookies only. It's for people who get the shots when they present themselves and they are ready to capture it. So those are five of the self-imposed rules that I have run into lately. There are more, and maybe we'll do a second edition of this show up the road. I'm curious, how many of these, if any, apply to you? Are you embracing one of these rules? And if you are, the only thing that I ask is that you think about why, you know, kind of be analytical about it, and then either continue to embrace it, because after you think about it, you go, this is what I'm most comfortable with, or possibly question it and do some testing and some experimentation outside of that rule and see what you think. Alrighty? And then if you have more that you want to add, maybe in preparation for another episode of this, please go to our Facebook page, The Digital Story on Facebook, and add a comment to this story. I would really appreciate it. This is the kind of story that I love reporting on. All right, here we go. Fujifilm to improve the X-T3 AF performance with new firmware, bringing it more in line with the X-T4. And this is an article on DP Review, and I have the link to the original article so that you can go check it out and see what you think of the entire article. But let me read you a little bit of this right now, and then I have a comment. In addition to announcing a camera, lens, and more, Fujifilm has also revealed it will soon release a free firmware update for its X-T3 that will improve autofocus performance and more. The firmware update will go live on October 28th, so you only have to wait a day, right, if you're listening to this when it's released. According to Fujifilm's press release, the improvements should see autofocus speeds more than double, taking focus times drop from 0.06 seconds to 0.02 seconds. That's a pretty good improvement, bringing the X-T3's autofocus performance more in line with that of the X-T4. And there's more. You can go to the article and see more about this firmware update. Now, the X-T3 has been around for a while, and yet they're releasing this firmware update for it to bring it more on par with the X-T4. And I love this about Fujifilm. This is one of the things they do that really impresses me, which they protect your investment. You made an investment in X-T3 and they want you to enjoy that camera for as long as possible. Now, the question that it brings to my mind has to do with our friends over at Olympus, who are also very good at firmware updates. And this is something I hadn't thought about when I was thinking about the transition to JIP. I'm pretty confident they're going to continue to make cameras and service cameras and all that kind of stuff for the foreseeable future. I think that's going to happen. But this other thing that Olympus is really good at, which are these firmware updates. I know my cameras that I have are not brand new Olympus cameras, but yet they have been updated many times and they perform pretty much like cameras that were just released. That's because of those firmware updates that they do. So my question is, my thought is, with the transition to JIP, are we also going to see those firmware updates at the rate that we've been enjoying them with Olympus, just like we're seeing with Fujifilm right now? So that'll be something to keep an eye on. Regardless, if you're an X-T3 shooter, this is great news, and I'm really happy for you. The essential steps to impressive video conferencing. I want to talk about this title that I have available on thenimblephotographer.com that I think is very timely, very timely. And the reason why I'm bringing it up this week, I know I haven't talked about it for a while, but I have received quite a bit of mail on it lately of people saying that it's really helping them and that they're really enjoying it. And I'm figuring, okay, if they're going to send me mail about this, I should talk about it on the show as well. So if you're looking to learn more about looking and sounding great for your next online interaction, I think you're going to enjoy this online workshop that I have on The Nimble Photographer. It's a 1-hour deep dive that focuses on three major areas of successful online interaction: audio, video, and environment. And during the course, I walk you through a variety of techniques that range from using gear that you already have to improving your chops through a few inexpensive purchases. And one of the things that's going on right now that's so cool is that all the major mirrorless camera manufacturers are releasing video conferencing software for their cameras. I mean, when I first started working with this, you had to have a video interface. They were hard to get for your digital camera. They're expensive, over $100 anyway. And so a lot of people end up using, you know, those little webcams that you clip on top of your computer that give you a little bit of an improvement over the FaceTime camera, but it's not huge. It's not nearly as good as what you can get from your digital camera. But now we can get webcam software for our digital cameras that doesn't cost anything and works pretty good. I've tested the Nikon. I'm testing the Canon right now. Obviously, I've played with the Olympus. This is really neat stuff. If you're thinking, you know what, I've got a camera, I've got some free webcam software for it, I want to do the little things that really make me look better and sound better. If it's family meetings, if it's job interviews, if it's classroom, if it's whatever it happens to be, I want to look better and sound better. Check out this video. Okay, it's available for $14.95. It's 1 hour. It's on the Nimble Photographer Workshop page, and I have a link to it in the show notes. I think you'll like it, and I think it will help you improve your online video conferencing game. Khaled gets a major update with upgraded RAW processing and new pricing. And this is from The Verge, and I have the link to the original article, which is very good in The Verge. I encourage you to read it if you're interested in this iOS app to improve your iPhone photography. And this is a good app. I mean, I've talked about this app before. I'm one of the early adopters of this app, and so that really paid off for me with this upgrade. Let me read you a little bit about this cool app that's great for taking raw images with your iPhone. Khaled has launched a new version of its popular iPhone camera app, now dubbed Khaled Mark II. It comes with a lot of new features. Those include redesign, upgraded raw processing, and a new pricing model. Khaled says Mark II features a bottom-up design with the goal of staying out of your way. And I can attest to that. I think they do a pretty good job of that. All the photo controls should now be within your thumb's reach, no matter what model of iPhone you're using the app with. The new typeface and even the preview of the last shot you took that sits in the bottom left corner of your screen matches the curvature of your iPhone screen. It's all meant to feel familiar to people who use Apple's default camera every day, which is, you know, one of my hesitancies about using third-party camera apps is because I like the default app so well. So in all honesty, the closer that these apps can come to my experience with the Apple Camera app, the more comfortable I'm going to be using them. But there's also a ton of advanced photography tricks. And this is really fascinating to me, especially in light of Pro Raw that we've been talking about that Apple introduced. We haven't seen it yet, but they've unveiled it. The new Mark II version of the app can now capture both RAW and the iPhone's computational processed photos at the same time through a feature that Halid calls coverage. Most photo filter and social media apps don't accept RAW images, but the benefit of RAW is that you get a photo without any processing applied that you can edit later. The benefit of coverage means that you get two images when you take the photo, one that you can post right away and one you can edit later. It also gains a new Instant RAW feature, and I think you can use this in combination with coverage. So coverage is really kind of a RAW plus JPEG, but it's not just a RAW. It's a RAW that, you know, can have some processing automatically applied. This new Instant RAW feature, which intelligently develops a single RAW image through a 17-step process without you having to adjust sliders or levels yourself. Quote, Instant RAW can work as a midpoint between a completely unedited RAW and a totally processed JPEG, end quote, Halid said in today's announcement blog. The company tells The Verge an Instant RAW image will look different than the JPEG you might get from an image with Apple's Smart HDR processing applied. Halid's processing approach was modeled after how film photography develops, the company says. And you can still send your RAW images off to other apps like Darkroom for more thorough editing if you wish. This all sounds very interesting to me, and I'm really looking forward to digging deeper into it. Now, here's the whole pricing thing. If you've already paid for the app, you get Mark II for free, as well as the year-long subscription with all the perks that it includes. If you're a new Halid user, you have a couple of options. You can pay once for the app, which costs $30 at launch, and $36 at some point in the future. Halid says it plans to raise that one-time price as new features are added to the app. It really paid off to be, you know, one of the early adopters of this app, because I checked on my phone and I do have Mark II, and I played with it a little bit and it works great on my iPhone X. So that saved me some bucks, at least for a year. But anyway, this is an interesting app, and I like the direction. This is not unlike what we talked about last week, where I think a lot of us, especially with our mobile photography, we want the benefits of RAW, or the flexibility of RAW, I should say, but we don't want to have to start from ground zero, from the bottom floor with our RAW files for our mobile photography anyway. We'd like to use some of that intelligence that's being built into our devices to, you know, do the first, in this case with Halid, you do the first 17 steps, give us something that's more in the middle. If we like it, we can fly with it. If we don't like it or we want to adjust it a bit, then we have the flexibility to adjust it. I like this direction, and I may or may not buy an iPhone 12. I haven't decided yet. But if I don't, having this for 1 year for free, or even for $30, is a lot cheaper than $1,000. So it's something to think about if you're interested in all this stuff. This sounds like a terrific update, and I'll report if I find anything that's really different than what I have said today, then I'll do a follow-up. But I'm going to be playing with it this week myself. All right, let's do a little virtual camera club news. First thing I want to talk about is we've just completed week one of our online Eastern Sierra Photography Workshop, and I'm having a blast. This is so much fun. I already have started with assignments. People are posting pictures. We're commenting on the pictures. People are getting feedback from me and from other members of the workshop. This is a chance for us to have other photographers who really care about photography look at our work and give us their take on it, instead of folks that, you know, God bless them, family members and so forth. We love them, But if they're not photographers, it's different than when a photographer looks at your shot and asks you questions about than when someone who isn't. And we're getting that in the online shop. And the conversations to me are fun. And in fact, the subject of today's podcast came out of the online workshop. I was going, what should I talk about this week? And then some of these topics, you know, always cropping the aspect ratio and things like that, surfaced in the workshop. And I go, this is kind of neat. I should share this with the entire audience. So everyone benefits from this online event. We get our second photo assignment this week, tomorrow, as a matter of fact, week two. And then we have the big powwow for 2 days in early November. So I'll keep you posted on it. But I have to say that we're off to a great start. And I'm probably going to plan another one of these sooner than later. Hopefully announce something right on the heels after this one completes. A big thanks to our Inner Circle members. We have some new members. Welcome aboard. Thank you so much for joining this endeavor. You are part of an artistic community that really cares about this podcast and this community as a whole and everything that we're doing. If you're interested in becoming an Inner Circle member, just click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of our digital story. And take a look at what's going on over there. There's a lot of perks. Some of our new members have asked me, hey, you said back a month ago or 2 months ago or 3 months ago that we would get this or that. Is that still available? And yes, it is. Yes, it is. And then I send them the stuff and they have the perk retroactively. I am a nice guy. I truly am. Right? So anyway, I mean, this makes sense financially. If you like this stuff, this really helps support the show. It's really a win-win all the way around, and you're hanging out with great people. Again, if you're interested in becoming an Inner Circle member, just go to our Patreon page. There's a tile on all the pages of the digital story. Take a look, see what you think, and a big thanks to those of you that are supporting the show right now. Speaking of big thanks, I want to give a shout out to our friends at Red River Paper. This is the place that you go for your inkjet printing needs. Yes, they have paper in the title, and yes, they have a ton of paper, great paper, a variety of paper. So you can get surfaces that are museum quality. You can get surfaces that are this beautiful matte finish. You can get surfaces that are metallic. You can get all sorts of stuff through Red River Paper. They have practically anything that you would need in the world of paper, and it is fun. And believe me, shots look different on different surfaces. So if you were to take one image that you really like, and if you were to print it on, let's say, the Polar Metallic, and then you were to print it on a luster surface, and then you were to print it on a fine art matte surface, and then look at that shot, it is three different shots. And that's fun. That is really fun. Unlike when you look at it on a computer screen, it's going to be basically, you know, the same shot or worse, depending on how the other screen is calibrated. But with printing, you have complete control over the image. In other words, when you get it the way that you want on paper, no matter who looks at it, it's going to look the way that you want it to look. You have control over that look. You don't have to worry that, you know, it's going to look wonky on this guy's computer and nice on the other guy's computer. This is one of the joys of printing, having that control to lock in the image exactly the way that you want, and then to have the flexibility to have that image appear so many different ways while you sort of figure out what is the best look for this shot. You do that, you get it on the paper, you lock it in, you remember your settings, and that's the way it's going to look from now on. That is cool. That is really cool. And Red River Paper can help you do that. They have a tile on all the pages of Digital Story. Click on it. Go see what's going on. Get yourself some paper and start making some gifts for the upcoming holidays. And a big thanks to Red River Paper for supporting this podcast. All right, that's going to do it for me this week. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm working on some cool stuff for next week. In the meantime, stay safe, be creative, and then come back and join me and find out what's going on next Tuesday. Until then, bye-bye now.